We'll hear arguments next in Wise against Lipscomb. I think you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Joseph Werner, counsel for the petitioners in this case, the Mayor and City Council of the City of Dallas. This is a civil rights case in which Negro voters of the City of Dallas challenge the all-at-large system of electing the City Council in Dallas. The District Court held that that all-at-large system was unconstitutional and that it denied Negro voters equal protection.
Was that the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment?
Yes, sir.
Not the 15th Amendment at all?
No, sir. No consideration. It was alleged that there was a violation of the 15th Amendment.
But the ground for the Court's decision was the Equal Protection Clause,
yes,
of the 14th Amendment?
Yes, sir.
Insofar as it, as the Dallas electoral system discriminated racially, is that it?
Yes, sir.
Not, there was no finding of any violation of Reynolds against Sims, or in its...
No, sir, there's no question. Since it was a purely at-large system in the beginning, there's no question of a numerical imbalance.
Couldn't
it was
a
white versus register type dilution problem.
And it was not a 15th Amendment decision.
No, sir.
But there was no finding of any constitutional violation here, was there, in the at-large system?
Yes, sir.
14th Amendment.
The purely at-large, you see, we started out with all 11 members of the council elected at-large, citywide. The district court found that that system was unconstitutional and that it denied equal protection to the Negro voters.
And you're not really, at least in this case, does not involve that issue, does it?
No, sir. No,
no,
sir.
You have a totally new structure now.
Yes, but it didn't find a one-man, one-vote violation.
No,
sir. No, sir. As I said, because it was purely at large in the beginning, then there was no possibility of a numerical imbalance.
Right.
Yes, sir. The district court, after it held the previous system unconstitutional, gave the City of Dallas and the City Council an opportunity to come up with a plan to remedy this constitutional violation. The court held hearings subsequently in which it received this 8-3 plan, which was generated by the City Council, and this plan involves the election of 8 of the 11 council members from single-member districts and the election of the remaining 3 members at large citywide.
Mr. Werner?
Yes, sir.
You refer to the plan having been generated by the City Council. Would you tell us exactly how that happened, step by step?
Yes, sir. The process was...
generated with a pistol up their heads.
On the 17th of January, the court held the original plan unconstitutional. 3 days later, the City Council adopted a resolution which informed the court that it was the intent of the council to pass an ordinance which would adopt this 8-3 plan. On February the 5th, the court commenced hearings on this proposed 8-3 plan and on 2 alternate plans submitted by the plaintiffs in the case. On the 8th of February, the district judge announced a preliminary finding that he considered the 8-3 plan to be constitutional. 2 days later, after the conclusion of that hearing, the City Council adopted the ordinance 14800, which promulgated as law the 8-3 plan.
Adopted a plan until after the court approved the plan that was suggested.
That's correct, sir.
Except by a resolution.
Except by a resolution.
Well, the City Council did it, though, didn't it?
Yes, sir.
Well, it just wasn't in the form of an ordinance.
That's correct, sir.
Is the resolution in the record?
Yes, sir.
Now, if that had been an ordinance, it might as well have been an ordinance.
Well, I think if it had been an ordinance, there wouldn't be any question at this point.
Well, why should there be any difference?
Well, I think in fairness to the respondents in this case, there is some ambiguity in the resolution. I think it clearly indicates that what the legislative body favored was the 8-3 plan. However, the resolution...
Well, the court thought that's what the city council was proposing.
Yes, sir.
That was clear enough.
Yes, sir.
Let me ask you this question. Did the city council have any power or authority to approve a plan definitively? Did it not have to be submitted to the voters?
Mr. Justice Powell, what we had here was a previous plan prescribed by charter. Now, obviously, the charter, somewhat like our city constitution, cannot be amended except by vote of the people. However, after the order of the district court declaring it unconstitutional, then that charter provision, our position is, ceased to exist. And we have the authority as a home rule city under the laws of Texas to evidence our actions either by resolution, by ordinance, or by vote of the people in the form of
a
charter.
You might just as well have passed the ordinance when you passed the resolution, except you probably would rather know whether it was constitutional before you passed
it
as an ordinance.
Yes, sir.
Is that the explanation why the council proceeded by resolution rather than ordinance at that time?
Mr. Justice Brennan, frankly, we don't know at this point. We can't recall, and I assume that that's what we were doing. If we'd had the benefit of Chapman versus Meyer, and which was decided within a few days.
What if it had been an ordinance when the resolution was passed? What if it had been done in the form of an ordinance? The district court would have done exactly the same thing with respect to it.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
I think it would have. And I think if it had been passed as an ordinance a few days before the hearing, then there would be no question that the city had promulgated this plan as law and that it was binding.
Mr. Werner?
Yes, sir.
The question I'm now going to ask you is not addressed to the merits in this case, but you filed an application for a stay with me last August. At least your name is on it, and it states the city council reapportioned itself and acted an ordinance.
Yes, sir.
And thereafter that the court held the hearing. Now, that was an error, I take it, from what you now say.
Mr. Justice Powell, if I said that, I have misled the court and you, sir.
I think I repeated it in a chamber's opinion, and I will say this in fairness. The district court said pretty much the same thing. But
well,
I now understand the facts. That is not what happened. I'm not suggesting that it makes any difference, as Mr. Justice White indicates, but I do suggest that the papers filed here, and while I'm on this subject, I must say that the response to your application didn't clarify it either.
Well, Mr. Justice Powell, what happened here was that there was on the 8th of February, there was no order entered, and the docket doesn't reflect any order. What happened was the judge made a preliminary finding that he considered the 8-3 plan to be acceptable. There was no order, written order of any description entered until March the 25th, about 6 weeks later, and of course the judgment in the case was not entered until May the 22nd, which was about 3.5 months later. So we didn't consider at that point that there had been any, at the time the ordinance was adopted, we did not consider that there had been any binding order of the court issued.
By that, I felt when I finally saw the papers in this case that both parties had failed adequately to inform me when this matter was before me last summer.
Yes, sir. Well, if we misled you in the court, we apologize for that, but it was, I think the contention between the parties has always been the authority of the city to make a change to the election plan through the means of an ordinance rather than by a charter amendment, and I don't think at that time any of the parties considered the timing of this ordinance to be critical, and I don't think we considered that the ordinance was adopted after an order of the court.
Now you're confusing me. You have spoken of it previously as a resolution, not an ordinance. Now, which was the source of the new 8-3 plan, a resolution or an ordinance?
Well, Mr. Chief Justice, there were both. On the On the 20th of January, before the remedy hearing, there was a resolution passed stating the intention of the council to adopt the 8-3 plan. Then the remedy hearing was held in the district court, and then 2 days after the conclusion of that hearing, the ordinance was passed.
And that was pursuant to the directives of the court?
No, sir. There was no directive for the court that we pass an ordinance.
But did the court, addressed itself to the plan submitted by the city under the resolution?
Yes. Yes, sir.
And said it was constitutional?
Yes, sir.
Now, did it purport to treat that as a court plan and say, I approve this plan? Or did they, you know, usually if the city's, passes an ordinance, it isn't a court plan. It's just something you either accept or reject.
Yes, sir.
What did the court do?
Well,
with respect to the resolution.
Yes, sir. On February the 8th, at the conclusion of the hearing, Judge Mahon, the district judge, made a rather lengthy statement from the bench in which he said that he finds that the 8-3 plan, in his words, passes constitutional muster. And he said, I will later enter findings. Well, he said he would later issue an opinion.
Did he incorporate that plan in a decree?
Yes, sir. The first writing from the court.
Well, you don't do that with an ordinance that you uphold. You just say it's constitutional, and you look to the ordinance to see what the provisions are.
Well, I may have misunderstood your question, Mr. Justice White.
Did he incorporate the very terms of the plan in a decree?
No, sir. Only by saying that he found
that
it's constitutional.
Oh,
yes, sir.
Okay.
Well, then, when he approved the 8-3 plan, it was simply a holding of the court that it passed constitutional standards, but it's not part of a decree.
No, sir. And there was no written order of any description entered until long after the ordinance was enacted.
I think I have the language of the district court that Mr. Justice White may have in mind. It's on page B-16 in the petition. At the end of the middle paragraph, that's B-16.
Oh, yes.
AB-16. This court then gave the city of Dallas an opportunity to perform its duty to enact a constitutionally acceptable plan. I find that it has met that duty in enacting the 8-3 plan of electing council members. Now, in light of what I now understand, the court, to say the least, used the word enacting somewhat loosely.
It was a resolution expressing an intent.
Yes. Yes, sir. And then
as an official expression.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And then after this decree, it was followed by an ordinance, and that in turn was followed by a charter amendment.
Yes, sir.
That is my understanding.
Yes, sir. That's correct.
Mr. Warner, is that quite correct? Wasn't it true that there was an oral opinion first, which was then followed by the ordinance, which was then followed by what Mr. Justice Powell just read?
Mr. Justice Stevens, there was the resolution, then...
On January 20th?
Yes, sir.
And then on February 8th, there was the remedy hearing?
Yes, sir.
Made an oral decision?
Yes, sir.
And then there was an ordinance, which is number 14800, which refers back to the oral decision. Is that not right?
Yes, sir.
And then after the ordinance was passed, there was then the written decision that Mr. Justice Powell read from in March.
Yes, March 25th.
That's where he used the word.
So this is after the ordinance,
yes,
whereas the oral decision was between the resolution and the ordinance.
The enactment is the ordinance? What is the word enactment there?
Well, I think the reference is to the ordinance, but I can't be certain what he meant.
By this time, there was an ordinance.
Yes, sir.
Is it not correct, Mr. Werner? At the time of the ordinance, there had already been a decision by the court, because the ordinance itself refers to the decision. And I call your attention to page A2 of the...
Yes, refers right to the oral decision. And if I may, I'll read from the transcript of the judge's remarks. This is volume 11 of the original transcript, page 86. The court says this court is accepting.
Do we have it in print here at all in the appendix?
No, sir, it's not reproduced in the appendix. The district judge said this court is accepting the city plan of 8-3. I am ordering that the election schedule for April of this year will proceed and elect the city council for this year under the city plan of 8-3 that has been presented to this court. At the same time, this court will, I'm going to enter a final order, I mean a judgment and opinion. It's going to take me several days and so forth. So he indicated at that time that it seems to us that this was a tentative or preliminary decision on the matter and that he intended shortly thereafter to render his official decision on the case.
This ordinance is an active procedure.
Now, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, it's our position that at the time that the court first entered a written order and its first binding order, that the city council had already promulgated as law this 8-3 plan, which is in contention. By the time the filing date arrived for the ensuing election, the plan had been promulgated as law, and by the time the judgment was finally entered in the case, of course, the plan had been promulgated as law by the city council. We contend that because the council had promulgated as law this election plan with full authority under state law, that this is not a court-ordered plan and that the special circumstances rule of the East Carroll case should not apply. We suggest instead that the rule of Burns versus Richardson applies and that the plan should be subject only to constitutional review. Alternatively, we submit to the court that even if the East Carroll rule is applicable, that the Court of Appeals has erred in saying that the special circumstances present in the case, which deal with the voting situation of Mexican-American voters, can be considered only if there's a constitutional violation. And we think that this is contrary to indications that we see in the opinion in the United Jewish Organizations versus Carey case. We do not think that special circumstances in a case like this depend on a prior showing of a constitutional violation. And we think that in this case, as in any equitable case or decree in equity, that the court should take into consideration the general public interest and should not enter a decree which will harm any segment of the population. And we think that the findings of the district court show that if an all-single-member district plan were put into effect, that the Mexican-American voters would very definitely be harmed by that decree. The other issue in the case which supports the use of a mixed at-large and single-member system is the finding of the district court that it would be beneficial to the city to have general citywide interests represented on the council so as to provide factionalism among wards within the city and so that the city council members would be exposed to a more statesmanlike view and that projects of interest to the city in general would not suffer from having been subjected to ward interests and factionalism. May it please the court, we'll reserve the rest of our time for rebuttal.
Very well, Mr. Werner. Mr. Johnston.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, it is the contention of respondents here today that this court is dealing with a fact situation that is clearly within the ambit of Connor versus Johnson and East Carroll Parish versus Marshall. We believe that the threshold issue is the standard of review that is to be applied by an appeals court, and that standard of review is determined by whether or not we're dealing with a court-ordered plan or a legislated plan. It's our contention that we have here very clearly a court-ordered plan. That is a plan that was ordered into existence by a federal court exercising its equitable jurisdiction in an adversary proceeding. Now, there is some ambiguity in the record as it's presented in the appendix, and I'd like to address myself to that at this time. Your questionings already have indicated some elements of that ambiguity. I would point out on page 147 of the appendix that the court itself stated that at the close of testimony on February 8, 1975, I made findings which approved the city's plan as constitutional. Accordingly, I ordered that the 8-3 plan, as had been offered by the city, be instituted in time for the April 1975 City Council election. Let me point out at this point that the City Council does not, either by resolution or by ordinance, have the power to change the election system in the City of Dallas.
Mr. Johnston, does it have authority by resolution to empower its legal counsel to make representations to the district court in a case like this?
It can and did empower its legal representatives to make representations to the court. And I have here and can supply to the court a copy of the accompanying letter that counsel for the city sent to the court. And that accompanying letter said, pursuant to your order issued January 17th, I'm enclosing a certified copy of the Dallas City Council resolution dated January 20. I think what's clear here is that this resolution was offered pursuant to an order of the court to offer.
Well, that sounds like we're going back to the forms of action to make this sort of distinction between a court saying we will impose a plan, but let's hear from the city as to what kind of a plan it wants, and saying that that's subject to a different standard of scrutiny than for a court to say the present plan is unconstitutional, let the city try again.
I think the distinction has to be made as to whether or not the city has the authority to try again under its own legislative scheme.
Well, why is that for the federal court? Why is that for a federal court to decide?
Well, we're talking about legislative power, and the Constitution of the State of Texas denies to the City Council the right to change its election scheme.
I don't see why we're talking about legislative power. We're trying to decide what standards the district court is supposed to use. Here, this was an unambiguous expression of the lawmakers' views in the city of Dallas.
The courts had before it in East Carroll the same kind of unambiguous statement of what the city would choose. And
well,
I think if
the district court had rejected the plan as unconstitutional and proceeded to draw up its own, it might be something else again. Or if the lawyer had just submitted the plan without any evidence that it was the official policy of the city.
Well, the case law to this point would indicate that this court has been looking, as in East Carroll, to the authority of the city to reorganize its
election system. That if the city had power to change the scheme overnight by an ordinance, and if their first action in response to the court's suggestion had to pass a new ordinance, the case would be different, you say?
Well, the case would be different. I would still urge the same result because we are dealing with a plan that was offered up after the fact of dilution of black voting strength. That finding had already been made by the trial court. We're not talking about a situation where, in the course of litigation, the city changes its election.
Well, that sounds to me like you're urging that the substitute plan offered was unconstitutional.
No, we're saying only at this point that it violates the federal common law of voting rights.
You don't mean the common law of voting rights, do you? You mean the appropriate equitable remedies for violation of the Constitution.
That language is not my own. It appears in the Fifth Circuit.
I would adopt it if I were you.
You don't find it in our cases, do you?
No.
So we're talking the precedents to which you refer and upon which you rely have to do with what's appropriate and an equitable remedy to repair a constitutional violation. And the cases to which you refer all involve violations of the doctrine of Reynolds against Sims. Not a single one of them that I know of involved a violation of such as was found here, which we don't have before us, and therefore we can't assess as to even whether or not it was a constitutional violation. But there's no claim that there was a violation of the so-called one person, one vote.
That's correct.
All the cases to which you refer, none of them that with which I'm familiar, and you're free to correct me, I may be wrong, I often am, have to do with at-large municipal elections of councilmen. And there's been a presumption in this case that multi-member districts to a state legislature are somehow the exact equivalent of at-large elections of municipal in a municipality to the city government, and they're quite two different animals.
Let me respond, if I may. The in East Carroll Parish versus Marshall began in the context of a Baker versus Carr, one man, one
vote
case. However, when the court approved the parish's posed all at large plan. In 1971, Mr. Marshall intervened, alleging that that plan diluted black voting strength in the parish. The district court rejected that finding, but it was preserved for appeal to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals found, in fact, that there had been a dilution of black voting strength, as alleged by Mr. Marshall. And so when that case, East Carroll, was before this court, it was before this court on that basis, as well as on the one-man, one-vote basis.
It did involve a school district, but it did not involve a home rule municipality, did it?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the fact that the city of Dallas is a home rule city should not overlook the fact that it is limited in its ability to devise its own election scheme. It must submit that.
Yes, but I'm talking about the constitutional test here and the remedy for a asserted constitutional violation. This violation was not a Reynolds against Sims violation.
That's correct.
And we're not talking here about multi-member districts to state legislatures.
That's correct. But it would seem to me that the federal remedy, which we urge and which East Carroll urges, which would require single-member districts absent unusual circumstances, is particularly appropriate when there was a finding by the district court as a result of an adversary proceeding that there was, that the at-large features of the City of Dallas election system diluted black minority voting strength. For the city to come back with three at-large seats preserving that same feature found unconstitutional would seem to me...
It's assertedly, that's a given in this case. But in assessing this plan, don't we again have to look and see whether an at-large election is unconstitutional? Isn't that at least the threshold inquiry?
Well, district court had already made findings.
Well, the district court did.
You're here now.
But you're here now.
Right.
And if there's nothing at all unconstitutional about at-large elections in a municipality of the governing body of the city, that's the end of this case, isn't it?
Well, if the court wishes to address itself to that issue, it may do so.
Isn't that the threshold issue here?
No one else, certainly petitioners that have not raised that issue and did not appeal in either the Court of Appeals.
Well, they certainly raised it to the extent that they say that the at-large election of three members of the city council is not unconstitutional.
That's correct. And I would point out to the court that Wallace versus House dealt with a commissioner form of government for a city, and that is a case where the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit has, as in this case, had to address itself with that issue. This court remanded that case to the Fifth Circuit for review in light of East Carroll Parish. This circuit examined the entire record and examined contentions very much like the city's here, that at-large elections preserve a citywide view, and rejected that as having established any kind of unusual circumstances.
Has this court ever held that that an at-large election within a jurisdiction is unconstitutional, be it city or state?
I think Wallace versus House, well, tacitly reaches that point because it goes immediately to the remedy.
But those were all based on one man, one vote violations, and then you get to the remedial phase, weren't they?
It's not my understanding that Wallace is based on one man, one vote. My reflection of the record in that case indicates that there was an allegation of and a finding in the Fifth Circuit that there was dilution of
Well, that isn't one man, one. That isn't exactly one man, one vote. Whitcomb against Chavez certainly rejects any notion that at-large voting in a city is per se or even semi per se invalid.
That's correct, but it does indicate that if the proof is there,
yes.
And White versus Register goes further than that, says that the proof was there in that circumstance, then you have established a constitutional violation of equal protection.
But one of the original complaint Whitcomb against Chavez wasn't that multi-member districts violated the Constitution, but that there was a violation of the one man, one vote principle, wasn't there? And then the question was whether the remedy was appropriate.
I can't recall the record at that point.
Let me back up on one thing that's left me somewhat confused. Suppose Judge Mahon, the district judge, had, after asking the city to make suggestions and the city made no suggestions, he had ordered the 8-3 plan. And they carried it out without a resolution, without an ordinance, simply carrying out the court's decree. What would be your view of what effect that would have on your posture now?
Well, our posture would be the same, that it was, in fact, a court-ordered plan.
Well, for all practical purposes, it was a court-ordered plan, wasn't it? And the city was simply, as a matter of comity or for whatever reasons, passing an enactment that carried out what they knew the court wanted and what the court had said would pass constitutional muster.
And what the court would require as a remedy. We have no objection as such and did not object at the time to the city offering to the court a plan. There is political expertise to be had amongst the members of the city council, and although their vote was not unanimous, their input was important, and we did not object to it as such. What we did appeal from, was preserving those same at-large features that the court had rejected in finding that there was dilution of black voting strength. Now, it's not easy to prove that there has been dilution of black voting strength by means of at-large elections. The proof is not simple, but it was met in this case.
It's particularly difficult, isn't it, when you have an 8-3 plan that is eight of them elected by districts and only three at large? Two at large, really, because one of them is the mayor.
That's why I think the remedy required by East Carroll is particularly appropriate in these kind of cases, because it instructs the city or whoever is working with the court in order to propose a plan that they must do several things, and one of those things is that they must establish that there are unusual circumstances which will justify the continuation of any at-large features in that plan. It's particularly appropriate in this case.
Well, you wouldn't suggest for a moment that in the course of this case, at whatever stage it was, that the city, let's assume that the city council of Dallas had the power under its charter to pass a new ordinance. It just simply passed a new ordinance. And the old ordinance that the court was considering just wasn't there anymore. The court would either, the ordinance would either go into effect unless it was enjoined and found unconstitutional, wouldn't it?
Well, of course, that's not the facts before us now. But
I know you say it isn't the facts.
One would have to, and I presume one would, seek some sort of injunctive relief.
But you would then have to submit that ordinance to the court, and that ordinance would have to be found unconstitutional before it could be enjoined. The Fifth Circuit in this case says that this ordinance is not unconstitutional.
The Fifth Circuit in this case never reached that issue and did not speak to that issue at all. It said that that was one of the things that
the
were...
The district court certainly did, didn't it?
The district court certainly did. Let
and
me point
said
out...
there was no unconstitutional impact whatsoever under this...
That's correct. And let me point out the difficulties that anyone litigating a plan in a hurry, where we had an election coming up in April and we were in February, we spent 5 years attempting to prove the unconstitutionality of the 11 at-large
exactly.
seats in the city of Dallas.
And the city came along and passed a new ordinance.
Let me point out that the city, and I think this is instructive, we have supplied the court with a copy of the ballot that was used in April of 1976 when the voters finally ratified that ordinance and finally amended the charter with regard to the change in the election scheme. And that ballot on page 16 of the document we supply to the court, which begins with a letter from Mr. Werner to an attorney in town, and says, shall chapter 3, Section 1, and Chapter 4, Sections 4, 6, and 8 of the Charter of the City of Dallas be amended to provide for the compliance with the federal court order for election of 8 members to the City Council from single-member districts and 3, including the mayor, at large. We think that's instructive because it indicates that the city believed, as we believe, that election that took place in April of 1976 was a housekeeping measure merely to reflect the changes that were already made by court order in the city charter.
Was it part of your submission in opposing the 8-3 ordinance that it was unconstitutional, or did you merely argue that it was an inadequate remedy for the previously found constitutional violation?
Our argument essentially was that it was an inadequate remedy.
So that there really never has been an issue that anybody's had to decide as to whether the 8-3 order was constitutional or unconstitutional. Is that correct?
The judge presumed that if it were constitutional,
it would be an adequate remedy,
although I may point out that the judge was troubled by Connor versus Johnson and throughout his opinion attempted to state unusual circumstances, such as the Mexican-American situation, which would justify the plan. But we were not anywhere equipped to argue the constitutionality of that plan because that kind of proof is very difficult to come by in the short space of time that we had.
If the fact or the conclusion of constitutionality were the end of the case, he would not have needed even to address the question of the Mexican-Americans. Is that not correct?
That's correct. Let me also point out that, as the government has pointed out in its brief amicus, that when this charter amendment was passed in April of 1976, Texas was at that time covered by the Voting Rights Act of 1965, something that it was not covered when the case was tried and the decision was rendered in 1975. And the city did not submit that case to the Attorney General for preclearance. The inference is that the city believed that plan to be a court-ordered plan, which was not required to be submitted to the Attorney General under the court's language in Connor versus Johnson.
The district court said he gave the city a chance to come up with a plan, and then he said, I find that it has met that duty in enacting the 8-3 plan of electing council members.
The judge's opinion is ambiguous in several respects. In that way, it is ambiguous because the court later on points out on page 151 of the appendix that the members of the council cannot on their own modify the charter to alter the voting
scheme. That may be so, but this seems to me rather unambiguous in saying that in his view, the plan, wherever it came from, passed constitutional muster.
Well, I think it is clear that the court and the court's belief.
And
he
you don't you believe that the interveners in that plan were urging that the plan was unconstitutional?
I think that's correct.
And so there was an issue before the judge about the constitutionality of the plan. He just didn't arrive at this conclusion sua sponte.
I can only respond that the court was, as were the parties, operating under intense time pressure.
Well, it may be, but the interveners claimed it was unconstitutional, and he said the plan is constitutional. Did you appeal that? You went to the Fifth Circuit, what did you say to them? You raise there?
Well, the issue that we raised in the Fifth Circuit was the appropriateness of the remedy.
Well, yeah, and did you say the plan was unconstitutional?
That appeal was some years ago.
Here's what the Fifth Circuit said. It cannot, however, be successfully maintained that the use of at-large voting to select three council members is itself constitutionally defective.
That's correct, and there's plenty of language from this court indicating that at-large features in and of themselves must be attacked on the factual basis, the factual matrix into which they've developed.
That is multi-member districts for a state legislative body.
Well, I would say that Wallace versus House and then applying it to a parish, and as in East Carroll, indicates the court's willing to go further than that. On this subject, let me conclude by saying that it's very difficult to distinguish.
You referred counsel several times to Wallace versus House. That's not a case from this court, is it?
Yes, it is.
We remanded it for
You remanded it for consideration in light of East Carroll.
That's the extent of this.
But it's not a decision on the merits by this court.
Well, to the extent that the Court of Appeals took it to mean that what was involved was the East Carroll issue, which is a one-issue case, essentially.
Well, then it's certainly a decision of the Court of Appeals to that effect, but not a decision of this court to that effect.
Well, I would only say, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that the clear implication of the remand of Wallace versus House was that what the Court of Appeals must consider was the appropriateness of the remedy. Exactly, and of course the Court of Appeals did do that, and cert was denied by this court.
But do you think all of our remands are that precisely tailored, that we never grant, vacate, and remand except having thought the thing through that carefully?
I would assume so.
That's not a fair question to ask you.
I think it's very fair.
A remand is a question, not an answer. If we were sure of the application, we would summarily decide the case, but if not being clear, we send it back and ask the Court of Appeals to consider the relevance of East Carroll and the others.
When the Court of Appeals did reconsider, it asked itself the question of why the case was remanded rather than simply reversed or affirmed, and concluded that the inquiry as to the appropriateness of the remedy under East Carroll was a factual one that they could undertake because they had a complete record before them, and they undertook at that point to determine whether or not there were unusual circumstances, found that there were not in the face of claims much like the City of Dallas here. And then
didn't it come back here again?
It did, and certiorari was denied. That's correct. I find it difficult to distinguish this case from East Carroll and from Wallace versus House, all the cases that have gone through the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Each time there were plans submitted by the legislative body pursuant to court order, each time that legislative body lacked the authority to draw up a plan, did not have the authority for one reason or another to implement the plan. In East Carroll, it was because of a challenge under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act to the enabling legislation. And in each case, the plan was ordered into effect by the court. Now, once you reach the threshold issue of whether or not the rule of East Carroll is going to be applied, the issue becomes whether or not there are unusual circumstances which would justify preservation of the at-large features. The district court found such in the Mexican-American presence in the city of Dallas, a minority group containing 8 to 10% of the population of the city of Dallas. The trial court's findings are confusing and contradictory, and I think ultimately not based on fact, and therefore an abuse of the discretion of the trial court. The trial court found that there was no present dilution of Mexican-American voting strength, although there might have been dilution in the past. The Court of Appeals accordingly indicated that there was, because there was no present dilution, there was their access was equal to that of the white majority, and therefore there was no need to enhance the benefits by these three at-large seats. But more importantly, it's the contention of the respondents that in order for there to be an unusual circumstance to support the Mexican-American issue of raised by the district court, there would have to be facts in the record to support a finding that single-member districts would restrict the access of Mexican-American voters. And there are no such findings in the record. In fact, the district court could only conclude that Mexican-American voters might suffer restriction in access under the single-member district plan. The record that we presented to the court indicates that in a single-member district plan, such as the ones we proposed, a district number two, would contain approximately one-third of Mexican-American population. And as such, Mexican-Americans, practicing the politics of coalition, as the Court of Appeals called it, would have far greater input put into the election of a member to the council than they would when they comprised only 8 to 10% of the population. In fact, we presented to the court a witness, a Mexican-American by the name of Robert Medrano, who had run at large for a school board seat and lost, and then when they changed to an all-single-member district plan, had won in a seat that was approximately evenly divided between blacks, Mexican-American, and white voters, therefore demonstrating, and the only factual demonstration in the record, that Mexican-Americans could, in fact, win in single-member district circumstances.
Well, does that prove any more than what has been said in some opinions of the courts, that people do not necessarily indulge always in block voting? If they find a candidate attractive, they'll vote for him as such. Just that's what indicates the reason for a half a dozen Negro mayors in the United States in large cities. Does it not?
It does, in fact, Mr. Chief Justice.
They vote for the man, not on a racial basis.
However, the record as developed in the trial of this cause from every expert witness indicates that in the city of Dallas, we have the unfortunate situation where block voting along racial lines is the rule, and anything else is the exception.
The record also shows that when the primary case was won on April 14th of 1944, all of the Negroes in Dallas were in a solid block.
That's correct.
And by election time, they'd split into four different groups.
Well,
that's what the record shows.
Four groups. And that was about 5 months.
The record will also show that in this case that since the institution of the 8-3 plan ordered by the district court, there has not been a Mexican-American candidate elected to the city council in the city of Dallas. Previously, there had been one, but since this time, although they have run, that I don't believe, I think the record will indicate that none of them have won more than a third of the vote and therefore have failed in their efforts to be elected at large. The court itself acknowledged in its opinion that at-large voting might operate in part as a restriction of the access of Mexican-American voters, and we think there is simply no evidence to support them as unusual circumstances. Finally, let me address briefly the issue of whether or not a citywide viewpoint can also be an unusual circumstance. I point to the court's opinion last term in Connor versus Finch, where this court indicated that a historic policy of multi-member districts was not a sufficient reason to uphold multi-member districts. And in Wallace versus House itself, the Court of Appeals originally attempted to justify a single at-large seat among five on grounds that they were avoiding ward parochialism, contention subsequently rejected on remand.
Mr. Johnston, was Conner against Finch a city council or legislative apportionment?
It was legislative apportionment.
Isn't there a fair amount of expertise in city management and city government to the effect that strictly election by ward does tend to lead to pork barreling in a way that it doesn't in a on a statewide basis?
If there is such studies, it was not in evidence in this case. That was asserted by some politicians who had been elected at large.
Mr. Buscemi.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by saying that I think that Mr. Justice Stewart is correct in suggesting that this Court has never found at-large municipal elections to be unconstitutional. This Court in East Carroll Parish School Board against Marshall, however, did find that the district court, in ordering at-large elections for not only the East Carroll Parish School Board, but also for the parish jury, which is the local legislative body, had violated the remedial principles that this court has set out in numerous reapportionment cases, all of them beginning with one man, one vote violations.
As this one did not.
That's right. In addition to the East Carroll case, this court has recognized in Dush against Davis and in Dallas County, Alabama against Reese, that there is the possibility that at-large municipal elections, local elections, either county or city, may result in the minimization or the canceling out, to use the court's words, of the votes of particular identifiable minority groups.
Well, that's always true when you have an election by majority rule. If a municipality is 55% Democratic, the votes of the Republicans are going to be canceled out.
That's true.
In an at-large election.
And that's what the basis of the court's holding was in Whitcomb against Chavis, where the court found that there was no restriction of access by blacks to the political process, but that blacks were primarily Democrats. There were lots of Republicans in Indiana, and the Republicans won a lot of elections, and as the consequence of that, there were very few blacks that were elected to the state legislature from Marion County, Indiana. But that is not what the district court found in this case, and I think the evidence supports the findings of the district court.
Don't you think there's a difference, at least from the point of view of political structure and political science, between a board of county commissioners or a county jury or whatever it may be called in various states on the one hand, or a school board on the same side, on the one hand, and a small city council elected at large with a city manager system in a home rule municipality on the other?
Yes, Mr. Justice Stewart, there may very well be a difference there, and we are not contending, and respondents are not contending.
And why should the same, if there is a difference, why should the same constitutional rule, at least, why should it automatically be transferred from one to the other?
Well, this case, as it stands now, it does not really involve a constitutional rule. We're talking about a remedy that's been...
Well, at least right at the threshold, it involves whether at-large municipal elections are, if there's any defect in them at all, doesn't it?
Well, that's true. And the district court found that in the circumstances...
The district court found so.
In Dallas, there was a defect.
For electing 11 of them at large.
That's
now,
right.
Whether or not that's right or wrong is not now before us,
that's
as
right.
I understand it. But certainly at the threshold, there is before us the question of whether the election of three members
that's
of the
right.
council, including the mayor at large, is defective in any respect.
Well, that's right. This court need not find that the election of three council members at large is unconstitutional.
Well, if it's undesirable as a matter of view of a remedy, isn't that the threshold consideration?
That's right. And this court has said, admittedly in one man, one vote cases, that reapportionment should prefer single member districts.
And never said so with respect to a city manager municipality. Never, has it?
Not in the context of one man, of at large
or
dilution.
No. Or in any context, has it?
Well, in East Carroll, for example.
Well, that's not a city manager municipality, is it?
No, it's a parish police jury.
with it. Your position is that even though we were to conclude, if presented with the issue on the merits, that an 11-man at large city council would not be unconstitutional, the district court simply should have dismissed the complaint. In this case, we should nevertheless affirm the Fifth Circuit, which held that three at large members were improper remedially.
Well, I think that the only issue before the court is whether the remedy was improper. Now, if Mr. Justice Stewart suggests, if the court finds that at-large elections may be ordered as a remedy, the court because the court does not believe that there is any constitutional violation involved in all 11 being elected at-large, then presumably the court would not need to affirm. But our suggestion here is that the violation that was found was indeed a violation, and that the appropriate remedy for a court-ordered reapportionment plan involves single-member districts. Now, as the district court pointed out, Dallas is completely free to present the 8-3 plan to the district court for the District of Columbia or to the Attorney General for preclearance under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. And then, and if that if plan is precleared, it will go into effect, and any court-ordered remedy for the constitutional violation found will be over.
After a district court orders it, are you suggesting that it must be pre-cleared? Judge's order must be pre-cleared?
Not at all.
Well, isn't this the judge's order? Isn't this the judge's plan?
Right now, this is a court-ordered plan. That's right.
Well,
and we're suggesting that as a court...
Why is it subject to Section 5, then?
We're saying that as a court-ordered plan, it is defective because it departs from the remedial principles announced by this court in earlier cases. We're saying that if Dallas wishes to have this plan...
Well, Dallas didn't wish to have it. The court imposed it on them.
That's true, but Dallas now says that it wants the 8-3 plan. And if
it wants it to something as though after it's ordered by this court, they might want it. But they didn't want it in the first place. They have it because the court ordered it, haven't they?
That's true.
Well, then
indeed,
why does
Dallas,
Section 6 get into the act?
Well, because if Dallas now wants the 8-3 plan, or if Dallas wants a 7-4 plan, or indeed if Dallas wants two single-member districts and nine members elected at large, they are free to submit that plan to the District Court for the District of Columbia.
Well, suppose we...
They have not challenged the finding of unconstitutionality.
Suppose we don't agree with you that it's a court-ordered plan. Suppose we were to view the resolution as such as a legislative plan. Would it now require Section 5 clearance?
Yes.
It would, even though it became such before Texas became a covered jurisdiction?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What authority is it for that?
Section 5 provides that the city may not enact or seek to administer any plan not in effect on November 1st, 1972.
Then is it your submission that if this is a legislative and not court-ordered plan, nevertheless there has to be an affirmance? Because there has not been a preclearance?
That's right.
Do you mean Texas, when it was covered, should have gone back and submitted every... When was it covered? 1970?
September 18th, 1975.
75. So it should have gone back and made a canvassed all the changes that had ever been made since 1972 and submitted them all to the Attorney General?
Yes, but indeed no changes had been made since 72. The at-large, the election...
Anywhere in Texas?
How can you know that in a state like Texas?
Well, I'm talking about in Dallas.
The question was Texas.
Your proposition was the whole state.
That's right. If there have been changes...
Anywhere in Texas, locally, statewide, any change in the great state of Texas, you're supposed to bundle them up in a bushel basket and take them all up to the Attorney General.
The ones that were not in effect on November 1st, 1972.
And did they do that?
Has all of Texas done it, or did Dallas do it?
Any of them. Does the Attorney General attempt to find out if they ever did it, or you just wait for complaints?
Or we wait for submissions.
All right. Very good.
Let me see if I correctly. In Perkins, I think the court held even a change of location of ballot, of polling places, required pre-clearance.
That's right.
Don't you suppose since 1972 there have been some changes of polling places in the state of Texas?
I'm sure there have, and I'm sure many of those have not been submitted, and I'm sure that the Attorney General has not exercised his right under the statute to bring private enforcement suits.
But perhaps elections, based on the changes in the polling places, may now be challenged because of failure to get a preclearance?
Well, I don't think that the change in polling place itself would be...
Has there ever been a court decision that Section 5 is retroactive like that? Or do you just read it on its face?
Well, I think that when Section 5 was initially...
It's possible to interpret it, I suppose, as meaning that any change hereafter that wasn't in effect in 1972...
Well, I mean, any change hereafter, by definition, would not have been in effect on November 1st, 1972.
All right. But has there been some court decisions on this retroactivity?
Well, I'm not sure whether there were any. When the Voting Rights Act was originally enacted, it was passed on August 6, 1975, but it referred to changes that had taken place since November 1st, 1964.
Well, have there been some submissions from Texas since it was included, based on the fact that this particular practice that is now being administered was instituted in 1973 and is still being administered?
Not that I know of.
So it's never even been construed by the Attorney General?
Well, I think that if there
had... Until now.
I think that if there had been such a submission, the Attorney General would have reviewed it under Section 5. I just want to comment briefly on the special circumstances that were noted by the district court. First of all, those circumstances were noted in the context of an evaluation of the A3 plan, in the context of an evaluation of the constitutionality of the A3 plan. The district court never said that it was talking about special circumstances or unusual situations that this court has referred to in speaking of departures from the single-member district preference in court-ordered remedies. The district court did not make such a finding, and indeed, the special circumstances cited by the district court in connection with its assessment of the plan's constitutionality are far different from the special circumstances noted by this court on the only occasion when this court approved multi-member districts in a court-ordered plan, and that was in Mahan against Howell, where we had a very special situation involving the Norfolk naval base.
Do you think it makes any difference in this connection between a city such as Dallas, which has had at-large voting since 1907, and the parish in Louisiana that had at-large voting only since 1968?
Well, I think that may very well make a difference with respect to whether at-large voting is useful in the city or whether it is constitutional. I don't think it should make a difference on what a court-ordered reapportionment plan should involve. I think that this court in Chapman against Meyer spoke about the long-time use of at-large elections and suggested
No, I think Chapman against Meyer is South Dakota?
North Dakota.
North Dakota. Well, didn't the court say that? Mr. Justice Blackmun would correct me. That there'd been no tradition
Senate. The court did comment, however, that there had been a tradition of at-large, that is, multi-member districts in the North Dakota House of Representatives.
But not in the Senate.
That's right.
And the court made a point of that.
That's right.
We'll resume at 1 o'clock.
Thank you.
You have some rebuttal time. I think you have 1 minute remaining, Mr. Buscemi.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. During the lunch and recess, I've obtained some information on the court's questions on the application of the Voting Rights Act to the state of Texas and changes that occurred between November 1972 and September 1975. The Attorney General has received hundreds of submissions involving such changes, both from Texas itself and from localities within the state. Some of those changes, we are informed, did involve changes in polling place locations, to answer Mr. Justice Brennan's question. Indeed, during the 12 months immediately following the application of the Voting Rights Act to Texas, more submissions were received from that one state alone.
I don't doubt it.
than from all the other areas covered under the Act combined.
Do you still contend that this case is subject to Section 5 submission?
Well, the relevance of this point to this case is that if the City Council could have, under state law, reapportioned itself by ordinance, and if such an ordinance had been passed, and if the 8-3 plan was now effective by virtue of a City Council ordinance, then that ordinance would have to be submitted.
Well, Mr. Christine, why didn't you answer the Chief Justice yes? Merely from the fact that it was April 1976, after the 75 coverage, that the ordinance finally became legal when it was approved at the referendum.
That's right. To the extent
that it didn't become effective until then.
Absolutely. To the extent there is
a... Well, then certainly, why can't you answer the Chief Justice that, of course, the 8-3 plan has to have preclearance under Section 5?
That's absolutely. That is the answer to the Chief Justice's question. To the extent that there is a legislatively enacted plan involved here, it is only through the charter amendment that was passed in April 1976, and that's what we've argued in the second part.
Was the city doing any more than rubber stamping what the court ordered?
No, the city was not. But in Connor against Waller, this court held that an enacted plan that just reproduces the terms of court-ordered plans is subject to preclearance.
In effect, then, you're saying that the judge's action is indirectly subject to review by the Attorney General.
No, we're saying that if the state legislative body or the local legislative body decides to adopt what a court had ordered into effect, then it's subject to preclearance. And that is entirely different because there are different standards.
Did the city have any choice about it?
Excuse me?
Did the city have any choice?
Absolutely.
About it?
The city had no obligation whatever to enact the A3 plan. They could have enacted any plan they wanted and submitted it to the District Court for the District of Columbia or to the Attorney General for preclearance. And there is currently pending in this court a jurisdictional statement in number 771376, United States against Georgia, in which a three-judge court did consider a submission of a change occurring between November 64 and the application and the effective date of the Voting Rights Act, August 65, and saying that that change was covered, but saying that it had been pre-cleared. The issue in the case is whether the Attorney General had pre-cleared it. Thank you.
Mr. Werner, do you have anything further?
Very briefly, Your Honor.
Will you address this question of preclearance, particularly in light of the referendum in April 76 after Texas was brought under Section 5?
Yes, sir. In response to the question by Mr. Justice Powell, I believe you asked, does it make a difference that we've had at-large voting since 1907? I believe you asked that question, Mr. Johnson. Looking at Mr. Justice Blackmun's opinion in the Chapman case, I get the feeling that this theory is based on a deference to state action and that what is really critical here is whether the federal courts are imposing some system of elections on a state which is contrary to established state policy. Now, if that's what we're really dealing with here, I think it's clear that the use of at-large voting in Dallas City elections is clearly established state policy, both of the state of Texas and of the city of Dallas, and that there is no affront to the sovereignty of the state of Texas by virtue of this federal court order, which either orders or approves the use of at-large voting. We had places, what we're dealing with here are places 9, 10, and 11 on our city council. Those places 9, 10, and 11 were at-large places beginning with the charter of 1968 was when we went from 9 to 11 members. So places 9, 10, and 11 remain absolutely unchanged since 1968. Furthermore, as you direct response to your question, Mr. Justice Powell, We have had at-large voting generally since 1907, and that, of course, was instituted in the city of Dallas before we had home rule, and it was done by act of the Texas legislature in 1907. So we've had it continuously in various forms since 1907. We've had it in our charter with respect to these exact three positions on the council since 1968, and I think there's absolutely no question that this at-large voting, and of course it's the at-large voting that we're arguing about here today that's in contention, and clearly the federal court did not impose at-large voting contrary to established state policy, so I see no reason to invoke the East Carroll rule in this situation. Now, Mr. Justice Brennan, with respect to the submission of the charter amendment under Section 5, I think very clearly the literal language of the statute requires preclearance. Now, the only problem that we see with this is that, as we all recognize, whether this is a court-ordered plan or whether it's a court-approved plan, a federal district judge has indicated his approval of the plan. And so if we come to the point where we submit the plan to the district court of the District of Columbia, I think we're submitting the approval of the local district judge to the further approval of the district court of the District of Columbia.
Or alternatively, the approval of the Attorney General of the United
States. Yes, sir. And the reason why I think this is significant is that I really don't think this is what the Congress had in mind. Of course, in the Sheffield case, the court construed the intent of the Congress in enacting Section 5. And I really don't think that what the Congress meant to do was to have the District Court of the District of Columbia or the Attorney General review something that had already been sanctioned by the District Court.
At the time the judge initially passed on the resolution, Texas was not subject to the Voting Rights Act.
No, sir.
He was then free to pass on the constitutionality of the substitute, whereas today, if they had been subject to Section 5, he would not have been free to address the constitutionality of this if he considered this to be a legislative submission, because that would first have had to go to under Section 5.
Yes, sir, and I think there's a difference here between what the district court did. Basically, we had ourselves a 14th Amendment lawsuit in the district court, the local district court, and I think Section 5 clearance is more closely aligned with 15th Amendment problems.
Did any of the parties to this action in their, as opposed to amicus curiae, raise the Voting Rights Act issue?
The respondents raised it in the Fifth Circuit, yes, sir.
And what did the Fifth Circuit say?
They disregarded that. They said nothing about it in the opinion.
They went off on another ground.
Yes, sir.
In his favor.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Well, tell me, Mr. Moore, I guess I gather from what you say, at least no decision has yet been made by Dallas whether or not to submit.
Well, until very recently, until Sheffield was decided, we didn't think we had to submit anything, frankly, and we did. We did submit some polling place changes and things like that over the last couple of years because we were afraid if we had to pick that up if Sheffield were decided against us, we were afraid the administrative burden would just be too much. So we went ahead and submitted those. But we didn't submit the charter amendment for two reasons. One was the question that the court just settled in Sheffield, and the other was that we weren't sure about this question of whether it was the fact that the district court had indicated some approval about it. But to try to clarify my point about the effect of what the local district judge has done here, I don't think that just the fact that the local district judge has approved a plan on some points and possibly not on the substantive issues required by the Voting Rights Act necessarily means that we don't have to submit it. What troubles us in this respect is that we don't really think that that's what the Congress intended to do. I think what the Congress intended to do was to prevent evasions and regressions that some of the southern states had resorted to in the wake of a court decision. In other words, a court would invalidate a certain electoral device, and then just as a dodge or an evasion, then the local government body or the state would resort to some other change. And I think clearly that's not what's happened here. And so, although, as I readily concede, we're covered under the literal language of Section 5, I'm not sure we're included in the congressional intent.
Do you think the Section 5 issue is here at all?
wasn't decided in the Court of Appeals, was it?
It was not treated in either of the courts below, Mr. Justice.
And again, it couldn't have arisen in the district court.
No, sir.
It's quite possible, I suppose, you're telling us that a plan approved by a court can be permissible as a plan that has been initiated by a legislative body, even though the initiation by the legislative body does not amount to legislation as such, and that even therefore, if it's not a court-devised plan and can permissibly be something other than what a court-devised, purely court-devised plan could be, nonetheless, it's a court-approved plan and therefore might immunize it from the necessity of submission under Section 5.
Well,
if later and adopted by way of a charter amendment, which this one was.
Well, now, that's no, sir, it's not exactly what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I can hypothesize a situation where a district court would approve a plan on grounds other than something that would satisfy the Voting Rights Act. The district court might not really address itself to what I regard as issues more closely related to the 15th Amendment, and still in a case like this approve a plan which was challenged only on 14th Amendment grounds. So what I'm saying is I don't think the local district court necessarily covers all the issues that would be covered in a submission to the Attorney General or the D.C. District Court.
He doesn't have to.
In a court-ordered plan, he doesn't need to live up to Section 5.
Yes, sir, I understand that.
And Brother Stewart is saying that this is, whatever the chronology here, this qualifies for that rule.
Yes.
This qualifies as a court rule rather than a legislative rule for purposes of Section 5.
Even though it might not be a court-ordered plan for purposes of our previous decisions with respect to multi-member districting.
Well, that's not
since
the position.
Since the initiative came from the legislative body.
It's a good position, yes, for you.
Except Mr. Werner.
I'm inviting you to accept a very comfortable position for you.
Well,
except Mr. Werner, I take it you can't have it both ways.
Well,
if this is a court-ordered plan for purposes of Section 5, then it ought to be a court-ordered plan for purposes of
my question suggested that you could have it both.
That's why I'm trying not to accept the invitation tendered by Justice Stewart.
If we agree with you in reverse, how does Chapter 5, how does Section 5 come in then?
Well,
you want the district court. You want to erase the Court of Appeals and go back to the district court.
Yes, sir.
How does Chapter 5 affect that?
Well, then we're in the position of being under the literal language of Section 5, but possibly not within the congressional intent, because we didn't do this as an evasion.
But I must say, Mr. Moore, I think our cases have not given much weight to that congressional intent as you limited Perkins and
yes, sir, I understand that.
All the others.
I understand that.
We have to go back on an awful lot of things we said, wouldn't we?
Well, this is a situation which the court has not precisely addressed itself to. It's a little bit different from Perkins and the other cases.
We came close to it in the District of Columbia case, did we not?
I can't answer that case.
The case that was decided by the District of Columbia court.
Yes, we're not. You know, this would not be what we regard as a disaster to have to submit it to the Attorney General or to the D.C.
And that's really not before us in this case, is it?
But I'm not
it's
sure
really not an issue in this case, is it?
Well, as we just said, it was not raised below, and well, it was.
We should not decide it if the Court of Appeals hasn't had an opportunity to pass on it, should we?
I think at best it should go back to the District Court to be considered.
Well, thank you, Mr. Winter. When is your next municipal election?
The next council election will be in April 79. We have council elections only in April of odd-numbered years, but sometimes and at other times we have bond elections.
So there's still some time if you had to go through the clearance.
Yes, sir. Ample time for that.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.